Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking a bit about how higher education has responded to globalization in the economy. And it connects to something that's a rather contentious issue everywhere in education, not just in higher education. And that's the issue of multiculturalism. What sorts of things should we be teaching and why? And should we be exposing students to other people, cultures, languages, ways of doing things? And if the answer to that question is yes, we might also ask, well, why? Should we do that just because it seems to be a nice thing to do? Or can you make the argument that there are economic reasons for doing that that very much connect with the globalization that we have seen in the economy, and we expect that that's just going to keep on going? And we'll try to ask a number of questions, including how should this be reflected in the curriculum, in how we do things, not just at this university, but at all universities. And our guest for the program this morning is Emmanuel Pastryk. He's professor of East Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Illinois. He's been here before on the program to talk a bit about East Asia, about the relationship between the United States and East Asia, how we think about that, how it is changing. And he's come back, and we're going to talk a little bit about this topic here this morning. We're glad that he could spend some time with us. As we talk, as always, if you have questions or comments, you're invited to call. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL or 222-WILL. Either way, 800-222-WILL. Either way, you want to call, you're welcome to do that. Well, thanks.
Thank you for having me here.
Let me just ask you this basic question. It does seem to be the case that when we talk about multiculturalism, and maybe this is more the case when we're talking about what goes on in, say, elementary and secondary education.
Right.
We talk about it as being something that seems to have a virtue all of its own, something that's good to do in its own right, at the very least because we see what's happening demographically with this country, and we say, well, that's a reality that we can't ignore. So we need to incorporate it into the curriculum, this idea that diversity is a good thing. We want to introduce children to it and give them some appreciation for it. Once we get to the level of higher education, though, this is a whole sort of different thing. And it seems that we ought to have a different set of reasons for why an institution like this should have some plan to address that. And so is that then, is our bottom line here now economics?
Well, it's an issue that I've addressed in teaching my students here at the University of Illinois. That is to say, I have to talk to students who are accounting majors or computer science majors and explain to them why they might want to know about other countries besides the U.S. And other places besides the state of Illinois. And I found by far the most persuasive approach is to talk about the not just demographic change, but the actual economic ties that the United States has with the rest of the world. And the example that I've often used when speaking to my students, and I say this from a position of someone in East Asian studies, although it applies to many other fields, is if we look at the partners, say, in trade and technology for the United States today in the year 2001, well, there's Canada and Mexico, which are often mentioned as being at the top, but they're essentially part of the same economy, the same economic system. After that, the list is Japan, followed by China, followed by Germany, followed by England, followed by Korea. That's the top five for North America. And if we look at the trends and the rate of change in our trade, and our technological ties, it seems quite likely that within 20 years, it will be China, Japan, and Korea. That means that you may have a student who's studying engineering today who thinks I don't have to learn Chinese. I can just learn computer programming. But he may be or she may be mistaken, because 20 years from now, you may actually have to know Chinese or Japanese for your job.
Mm. Something that surprises me a little bit, because I think back, I don't know how many years, maybe 15 years, maybe more,
mm-hmm.
When you look back, there was a time when we were obsessed with the economic challenge posed by East Asia. And
right.
There was so much written about the fact that this was a region of the world that was a growing economic power mm-hmm. that would be something that we would have to at least collaborate with, if not contend with. And there was an awful lot of talk about how it's really important. We need to learn more about Asia. We need to understand the culture. We need to have university students studying I suppose at the time it was Japanese. That was the thing. And then there was a growing appreciation for other countries in East Asia being important. But having gone through all that soul searching,
yes.
When you look at curriculum and what has happened in the university, it doesn't really seem that anything has changed very much.
Well, there have been gradual changes, although I personally feel that the changes have not kept up with the actual economic reality. In the 1980s, it seemed as if Japan, this particular economic powerhouse, was what the United States had to understand. That is not the argument that I would make, even though as a professor of Japanese, that's my favorite. It's rather that if we look at the whole trade for the United States or the interactions, economic, intellectual, with the rest of the world, that not just Japan, China, Korea, India, the Middle East, many countries in South America have extremely strong ties with the U.S. And in fact, starting to rival the ties that the United States has with Europe, say, the sort of traditional system of England, France, Germany, and Italy. If one looks at the curriculum today, we have added a few more classes. But to take the most sort of extreme example, if you go to the Department of Classics at the University of Illinois, we have professors in Greek history or in Roman history, but there's nobody in classic Islamic or classic Chinese, classic traditions of other parts of the world, even though in terms of the demographics, the makeup of our student body, the United States' ties to the rest of the world in economic and technological terms have changed drastically. So there is a clear discrepancy between the curriculum and the actual economic, social, demographic reality of the United States in the 21st century.
It also seems to me that one might initially say that this is somehow a product of Eurocentrism. And at the same time, though, it seems that in some ways at this university, perhaps at others too, there has been a pulling back from internationalism. And it's not just that we're giving a lot of attention to, say, Europe as opposed to East Asia. It seems that in some ways that we're actually not giving enough attention to the rest of the world. And it's not so much an issue of putting resources one place or another. It's just we're not putting the resources there at all, it seems.
Well, the United Nations would be the perfect example of that and the problem the United States has had in funding an institution which the United States founded. So that issue is a very hot one. I personally feel that there's no way to win that battle, that isolationism or its various different forms, even if we like it, is no longer an option for the United States in the age of the internet, in the age of growing international cooperation, in which, say, in wafer fabrication, that you have multinational corporations in four or five countries teaming together in order to come up with the funds necessary to develop the next generation of technology.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Emmanuel Pastrank, he's professor of East Asian Languages and Cultures at University of Illinois. We're talking a bit about globalization in higher education and whether, in fact, and we're not just talking about University of Illinois. We happen to be here, but it's not just an issue for this university. It's an issue for others as well. How well the university in its course offerings and in the way that it does things is responding to these kind of changes in the economy and whether it's offering the kind of courses and thinking in the ways that perhaps it should to prepare students to work in this new economy. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I guess one might ask the question, this question. I'm sure that there are places in this country where you can go and you can study Chinese history and Islamic history and those languages and all of those sorts of things. It's not as if no American university is doing it. But does every university need to?
Right, right. Well, the University of Illinois does as well, and we have a very good selection. However, there's quite a difference. I just give one sort of example. One of a signed book, actually, I believe, for the University of Illinois is this Economic History, I think, of the World. And if one reads through that book, one gets basically until the 19th century a history of European economic history. And then suddenly it becomes global. But it gives very little about the details of the histories, the economies, the traditions and approaches to human relationships in the Islamic world, in South America, in Africa, in East Asia. I personally feel that the undergraduate who, after he goes to work for a major corporation in Illinois, will have to deal with people from all over the world, even if you're in agriculture, right? Our major potential buyer is China. So if you want to sell soybeans to China, you may find that you're going to have to understand Chinese customs and language with considerable sophistication in order to work in the agricultural economy of the state of Illinois. Now, if you read a book in which economic history is only about Europe until the 19th century, you may be missing something that would serve you well in your career right here in the state of Illinois.
Hmm. I suppose somebody might also come along and make the argument that says, well, that some of the responsibility, perhaps most of the responsibility for preparing employees to do that lies with the employer. And that if you're going to say you're going to become an agronomist,
yes,
go to the University of Illinois and you learn everything there is to know about growing soybeans. That's
right.
That's the job of the U of I, to train you to grow soybeans. Now, if you go to work for a company, they want to sell soybeans to the Chinese, then maybe you would say, well, it's up to that company to prepare their employees to go sell beans to the Chinese. That's really not, and you know, one might say, well, it would be swell if in the course of learning everything there is to know about soybeans, you also took a couple of survey courses about East Asia, but you know, that would be nice. But when it comes really down to providing the stuff that the employees need, well, maybe then that's their employer's job.
Well, if one looks at it from the other side, say in a country like Japan, when Japan saw the United States as a major market for automobiles in the 1950s and 60s, the universities in Japan put immense resources into trying to train Japanese to speak English. Now, some of that education was not as good as it could have been, and it could be argued quite strongly that the Japanese economy would have gone a lot further if the education in the English language had been a little better. So you didn't have this generation of Japanese businessmen who spoke in broken English. I think for the United States, if we're concerned about the future of our students at the University of Illinois specifically, that they will get better jobs and be more successful if they understand the traditions and habits in these various other countries that are now major, major trading partners for the United States in everything from agriculture to high technology, and that will be in the long-term interests of our state in our country, and is not a simple do-good multicultural argument, although I have nothing against doing good.
So basically what you're arguing is that it would be good for this university, for example, other universities, to have more faculty in this area to offer more courses in this area. You're not talking about requiring students to do particular things, but that for students who want those skills and who think that they're important, we ought to have courses for them to take.
Absolutely. Although the question of what students want is related to what they're presented with. That is to say, if you take a class in computer science and the professor tells you, well, I think you're going to need to know some Chinese or Japanese because of the trends in East Asia towards high technology, then you might consider taking those courses more seriously than if your professor never mentions that issue.
Well, that gets another issue, then, which is advising and what students are told they should be doing. Students, mm-hmm. as you say, you come to the university, maybe you decide you're going to study a particular thing, mm-hmm. but then someone is going to have to sit down with you and say, all right, this is your goal to learn about this. Here's how you get there. This is what we think you should take. And there are, in many cases, requirements. We say you absolutely should take this, but then different advisors maybe have different ideas about what else it would be good to take. And how then do you address that when you get at the people who are telling these incoming students, okay, this is what I think
right.
that you should be taking?
Well, this is a much more difficult issue at a university of the scale of University of Illinois. How do we advise each student on these issues? And I do not have an answer for that. Although I think many students would be well advised to consider learning about the rest of the world, even if they intend to spend their whole life in Rantoul working for an agricultural related corporation. That this is what is going to happen in the same way, say, of the internet, that at this particular time we see these changes as being minor changes on the fringes of our society, perhaps, but the changes are quite profound, and the ties, say, through the internet or through international commerce, which may make it the case that someone here living in Urbana may have very close economic and cultural ties to someone in Mongolia or Brazil that may exceed their ties to their neighbor, that this is an entirely different ballpark, in my opinion, the way in which the economy and technology is evolving in the 21st century.
We have a caller to talk with in Bloomington, Indiana. Let's do that. Line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I think it's very good to study Eastern societies, but I think I detect some opposition to, I guess the term is Eurocentrism, Western civilization. And there has been a considerable a disparagement of Western civilization in the academy. Right now, Western civilization, led by the United States, it now dominates the world, at least commercially, is the most successful, the most dynamic civilization in history, and we don't like it. I mean, shouldn't we learn? If I wanted to go to the University of Illinois and major in Western civilization, could I do it? Are the courses even available?
Yes, absolutely. And I happen to have great respect for the Western tradition. I was a literature major. I took lots of classes in English literature, and I read it to this day. So I do not see it as an either-or choice. I feel the University of Illinois could supplement or increase the offerings with regards to the economies or the cultures of other parts of the world, and that would not be because we think that the Western tradition, which is respected across the world, is something which belongs in the dustbin of history, but rather that in the reality of economic change, which we cannot stop, that we need to supplement and make up those empty spots in our curriculum.
Yeah, well, talk to this for a second. Hmm? Here's my problem. Here we are living in the United States, which dominates Western civilization, and
right.
is commercially the most successful, the most dynamic economy the world has ever seen. Here we are. We're in the middle of this dynamic, successful economy, and somehow we don't like it. Now I have no objection whatever for studying Eastern societies. I think we can. There's a great deal to be learned from them.
Mm-hmm.
But can we at least acknowledge our own success?
Well, absolutely. I guess the qualification I would put on that is that whereas the United States, in economic terms, had much closer ties with England, France, Germany, and Italy in the 19th century, the economic ties with China, Japan, Korea, India, and South America are about to eclipse in absolute value those economic ties with Europe. That means that for our own national interests, we have to understand that part, those parts of the world better than we do now.
Well, I fully agree with you that if we want to, I would surely advocate expanding our trade with all of those countries. That's good, and I certainly have no objection to that, and I agree with you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have room for others, and I would encourage you, if you have questions, comments, you can give us a call, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. So you really, I guess I want to, not to, at the risk of overemphasizing the point, you're not saying that the University of Illinois or university should be doing less or should be offering less. You're not saying we should get rid of the Department of Classics or, you know, those people who study the political institutions of contemporary Germany. What you're saying is that we ought to be doing more. And if anything, it underscores the point that to be well educated it's not requiring that you learn, you know, less. Requires probably today that you know more.
Classics is a good example. The classics department, I think, is down by 5 faculty members from what it was 7 years ago. So the question would be, when we hire 5 more people from the classics department, would it not be in our own national interest to hire 1 in East Asian classics, 1 in Islamic classics, 1 in other fields which could be considered classics, so that the very term classics expands in its meaning, and there's a sense in which we are looking at the entire world, which is, again, not just an issue of what you think you like or what you think you're morally obligated to, but what is actually in the long-term interest of the United States.
We have other callers. In fact, suddenly we have 3. So let's talk with them, starting with line number 1 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I want to make a comment about you, the announcer.
Yes.
The host.
Yes.
You seem to be very narrow-minded in your responses to his suggestions, and I'd like to point out some of the failures that has caused in subjects being taught here in the past. We used to teach mathematics with no applications to it, and the kids would say, hey, why should I study this? There's nothing I can do with it. And you know the difference between a problem where you just multiply something and a problem where you have to figure out what the square feet are to be covered with linoleum on a floor in a garage you just built. One of those things shows you how to apply the knowledge you're getting. One of them just leaves you there with what we call theoretical mathematics. So I would like to back up your guess and say that it's much more worthwhile to teach somebody something with the tools of how to apply it in the real world than to just send it out there as basically a theoretical airhead.
Well, I guess I have to say I agree with you. I guess I'm not sure what it was that I said that led you to believe otherwise, but
you were presenting a particular position there, I think.
He said that he thought that people should be studying how to get along with all these other cultures, and you came down on them really hard for not being Eurocentric.
I see. Well, I guess I hope people would appreciate the fact that the questions I ask here are intended to provoke particular responses, not necessarily to.
Got a response.
All right, very good. Not necessarily a reflection of my personal views on a subject. All right. Well, good. I appreciate the comment. Let's go on to another person here. This is Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I don't know. I've been listening to this whole show, and I may be wrong, but it sounds like the last caller was maybe confusing you, David, with the caller before him. I'm not sure about that, but what he said didn't make any sense to me. Anyway, but that's not why I called. I have been listening with interest because I think it's important to study other cultures and other languages. But it seems interesting to me that the perspective that the guest has been taking is a really kind of instrumental perspective. Like, it's good to study other cultures because it will help us succeed in the global economy. And I think it's interesting that there's a lot of talk about the global economy and how people can succeed in it and stuff. But there's also been a lot of talk in the last couple of years about some of the problems with the global economy, not only for people in the United States, but especially for people in other parts of the world. And I wondered if you feel like there's something about studying Eastern cultures that might, you know, speak to that or to help people have a more, I guess, holistic perspective on the global economy.
What were the specific problems that you were imagining there in that result from the global economy?
Well, I mean, just thinking about a lot of things like, corporations that are creating agricultural practices that maybe interfere with some of the ways that people have been doing agriculture in other parts of the world, and the way that the global economy affects the environment, for example, with decreasing standards for environmental protection and things like that.
Right. I personally do not see the move towards a global economy in and of itself as a positive. I see it as an ineluctable change, and we can find both positive and negative. If you see American workers who lost their jobs because whatever product it is can be made cheaper in another country, or if you see American corporations who find that they can build factories that pollute easier in other countries and then ship the product back to the United States, I don't see those as being positive developments for either our country or the world as a whole. However, I see that we have an opportunity here when we look at the way we educate people about the world, the globe, the issues involved, to set ethical precedents for how these students, when they go to work for corporations or work for the government, will deal with these problems, which cannot be avoided. So I do believe that we should be aware of the very serious problems that emerge. But I guess on this particular occasion, I'm talking in the large sort of global view of the university. And I hope that when we include other countries and other global issues, that, of course, we will discuss the negative and the positive.
Okay, yeah, I guess one thing that I appreciate that perspective, and I was thinking about when you were talking earlier about, for example, the history of the world economy and only considering Western economies until, you know, the 19th century or the 20th century. Do you think that there's things about studying cultures prior to the 19th century that might kind of inform that perspective?
Perspective meaning our perspective on the world as a whole?
Yeah.
Absolutely. There are aspects to the way in which the Chinese go about living in a modern world with the email and air conditioning, which are absolutely unrelated to the Western tradition. So that although they may live in a building which seems entirely Western to you, whatever that means on the surface, they interact with each other in a way which is informed by a Chinese tradition which goes back many thousands of years. And that tradition is becoming more and more powerful across this globe. The number of people who live in the United States today who use only Chinese or only Spanish as their language for TV, for newspapers, for talking with their friends, is in the millions of people. Now, you may say, well, they should all learn English, and I don't disagree with that position at all. I'm not saying that you say that. Some people may say that.
One might say.
But this is a reality that we're going to have to deal with.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
All right, thank you. We are just a little past the midpoint of this part of Focus. We're speaking with Emmanuel Pastrank. He's professor of East Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Illinois. We're talking about globalization and higher education and just how well institutions like this one are responding to the changing economy of the world. And are we offering students the course offerings that they really need to succeed, perhaps to help this country succeed, and to help, in a sense, have a better understanding of people outside of the United States who didn't come up in through European culture.
Western and culture. Inside the United States.
And inside. Well, excellent point. Excellent point, indeed. Because, this, of course, the same things that are happening in the world are happening here. This country is becoming much, much more multicultural. And as you say, with very growing importance of Latin culture and Asian culture. Okay. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And I guess, we should note that, in fact, on this campus and a lot of other places, people are engaged in this very debate, not just around this issue, but looking at this very large question of the future of the, quote-unquote, the university.
Absolutely.
And how, in fact, maybe it should change or is changing for is and which changes are good and which changes we're not so sure about. I guess the one question I ask is the way things can go on the university. You know, it's one of those cases where the wheels grind exceeding fine, but they also grind slow. You know,
That's true. This
could be something that we'd be talking about for 10, 15, 20 years, and maybe then we'd get around to doing something about it. How do you think? All of this discussion will actually lead anywhere?
I believe that these issues are being discussed quite seriously. The wheels at a university like the University of Illinois go slowly, but once they're on track, they roll and they cannot be stopped easily. The issue to me is the rate of cultural change or technological change in our civilization today. If you look at, say, the way in which we went from the first time someone picked up a stone to the development of an arrowhead, we are talking about a period of tens of thousands of years. And then the different kinds of arrowheads also took thousands of years to develop. So the rate of change which existed in the world until the 19th century was relatively slow. It sped up in the 19th and the 20th century. Now we live in an era in which your computer you buy today is probably outdated when you get it, and if not, will be outdated in 6 months. So the technological ties which make it possible for you to email, teleconference, share databases, and exchange with anyone anywhere in the world anytime for free are expanding at an unbelievably fast rate. However, our traditions within universities, within our own relationships with those people around us, it's a culture of its own. It is not changing as quickly as the technological changes are taking place and the global economy is evolving. Now, I'm not saying that slower change within the university is bad. Actually, I think it's good to keep us from going over the deep end. But there are discrepancies which are born and that we will just have to deal with.
We have other callers. Let us talk next with someone in Champaign on line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm agreeing with you. I think that putting things like East Asian studies and Russian studies and whatever other studies in liberal arts ghettos and not applying them to other subjects is going to come back and bite us really hard at some point. That sort of thing really needs to be integrated throughout what people are studying and not just be considered some sort of airy-fairy thing that people do. Another thing is that people don't even learn Eurocentric history very well, and I'm talking about university-educated people. Otherwise, I think people would realize the parallels between our situation right now and looking at maybe 100 years ago if you were a citizen of the British Empire that the sun never set on.
Very true.
That's really all I have to say.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to Olney for someone else here. Our line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I understand that in order to negotiate or bargain with those with an Eastern cultural background, it would be well to have read Sun Tzu, for instance, or the Art of War, or that Westerners take certain things for granted that may not be understood the same way by Easterners.
Very true. It's, the cultural background, one can wear a suit and drive a modern car, but the strategies used are often quite different. And moreover, if one reads someone like Sun Tzu, one might find strategies for how to conduct oneself, which you, the American, may not have thought of and might be very applicable in your daily life here in the U.S.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I guess just to, again, to, you know, at the risk of somebody saying that I was narrow-minded, one might say, well, really, though, we're all living here in the now in the 21st century. We're modern industrial countries. We all go to fairly similar kinds of universities. There is a certain kind of international commercial culture. And really, how different is it to be a business person in today in Beijing or in Tokyo from being a business person in London or New York?
Well, there's considerable similarity, so I don't want to go off the deep end in that respect. I would say, in a pragmatic way, the argument would be to the student studying accounting or studying finance that when you go to Beijing or to Tokyo and you're going to be doing a lot more business with that part of the world than your father did or your grandfather, that knowing some of those fine details may make the difference about whether or not you get that $50 million contract. So although you may not need to know in detail about the Tale of Genji or even like eating kimchi to close a deal, you may find that in the long term, even if you're working entirely in computer science, that what makes the difference to your corporation or to your country is that you grasp the subtle details and that is what swayed people.
Okay. To another caller, this will be Champagne. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. I think it's a really good topic. And as the economies, like, integrate, as I was reading a Tom Clancy novel, he indicated that, say, if China, Japan, and Taiwan were to have their economies become closer, that they would really rival the rest of the world. And it's obvious that China is growing economically. But this seems like it's more of a two-way street than just you're kind of indicating that it's. I mean, they don't have the luxury of really ignoring our economy either. And so I'm just wondering, I'm sure they're teaching English and French and German to their students, but what's the role of the Internet and of large corporations? I mean, do you think that it's, I guess my question is, do you think it's more up to the big corporations or governments to take a step up in teaching these languages, or is it like up to the Internet technologies to sort of create like translation technologies that people could basically use, like say the guy in Rantoul, he could use something like a translator where he would never really have to learn the language.
Well, that technology will be there, although it won't be there yet. And I don't think it will eliminate the need to understand these cultures on their own terms for our own interests. I don't know if I can answer the question effectively.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, I didn't know if there's that out there yet, but you're saying that it really is.
I think if we look at it from the other side, if you go to Japan, there are, in the newspaper or in discussions in academic settings, people who are very aware of the not only the President of the United States, but individual governors who have a very good sense of where a company like Microsoft is going. On a daily basis, it comes out in the newspaper. If you read through Chicago Tribune or the New York Times and you try and figure out what's happening in Japan relative to major corporation like Honda, you're going to have a lot of trouble getting much of a grip because it's not being reported in detail. Now, you might say that these are foreign country companies and they're not that important, but what happens to the head of president of Honda might have a very profound effect on the United States, and you're just not going to get the coverage of that in the press or in the academic circles that I think you as an American citizen deserve.
The other thing is that the Internet really isn't acceptable in China, which is kind of kind of a hindrance, I guess, to their development of their economy.
It's changing. I think that the Chinese government about 3 years ago was faced with a terrible paradox there, maintaining control or limiting the Internet or committing to the Internet, which would seem to be essential to economic growth. And my general impression in China today is that the walls are breaking down, that there's more and more commitment to the Internet, more and more websites, and China, because of its population, may be a very dominant player in the Internet economy in the future.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. And now to line two. This is also Champagne. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
I think it's very important to know the different cultures, because even in America, in certain sections, if you look a person directly in the eye, a person that you've just met, that is very disrespectful, and he'll think you're dishonest. So if you're selling something, like in the mountains and places like that, they won't listen to you, they won't buy. But at another place, you must look a person in the eye. So you need to know what goes. I remember 20 years ago reading a story about American that went to Chinese to sell cigarettes, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave out samples. The next day he came back and says, well, how many do you want? Well, they wouldn't have anything to do with him, because he found out there you had to first get to know the person. You had to go through all these cultural niceties of how are you, and I like this wonderful country, and, you know, build them up and everything. And maybe not until a second or third time you met with a person would you tell them what you're selling. And that person had a very good success in selling stuff. So it's really necessary to know the culture. And when I was in Japan, even the Japanese looked down on the people that live in Osaka, because they said they are pushy when they're selling and everything. Well, Osaka was one of the busiest places in Japan, but it just wasn't the normal way to do things. Of course, now they're getting more American, and so you don't have to go through that quite as bad. That's all.
Well, you want to comment on it? I expect you would probably agree.
Well, there is quite a bit of variety, and I completely agree. I would take again the issue of, say, growing soybeans, that if one looked at in the 19th century, most of your work in growing soybeans went into being aware of what the weather patterns would be, working hard outside, planting, harvesting, and keeping accounts. In the 21st century, we might find that you don't have to worry about the weather because you have a satellite which takes care of all that. You have robots who do the sowing for you and the harvesting, and you have your internet station there right in your farm that allows you to contact buyers all over the world. So you're not going to be putting that much of your time into hoeing, right, or harvesting. So where will your efforts be devoted? Your efforts will be devoted either to the issues of biotechnology and how to grow soybeans better and more effectively, or they're going to be devoted to how to sell them. And that means personal relations with people all over this country and all over the world. So the amount of time as a farmer that you spend thinking about your personal relationships with people all over the world may increase quite dramatically in the years to come.
One more caller here in Urbana, line three. Hello.
I would say from my own experience that as a kid growing up in New Jersey, never expecting that I would see any place beyond, I mean, to me, I think the farthest west I got was Gettysburg. And I guess a lot of my classmates never got any farther than that or never even got out of New Jersey. But now I've been to a whole variety of places, and I've had a chance to live in a couple of foreign countries somewhat briefly. And one of the things that to me has been valuable about that is really realizing how arrogant we are about what we assume are the norms and in terms of whole ways of thinking. And if we can find ways to help people lose that arrogance and realize that there might be other points of view, that are no better or no worse, that we have our own failings here in this country. And despite what the Bloomington caller said, I don't think that that's putting down our culture. It just is a recognition that we're human beings and we have failings. I think that it's important to recognize that we have our own failings and to figure out and to get a chance to see how other cultures see us. It's really eye-opening. We're not viewed as so great. And if people would like to read something about a cultural miscommunications, and it didn't have to do with just translation problems, there's an interesting book called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. It's about a Hmong child and her disastrous encounter with American medicine. And it's a really interesting look at the cultural differences in between the Hmong and Western medicine, and to think about our culture, think about some of the questions that raises about how we interact with other people. And I don't know that a translation program on the Internet is going to get across to anybody or is going to be able to ever pick up the cultural stuff that comes along with word meanings. I don't know that a dictionary ever can do that. I think what people need is to understand is they need a cultural broker to help them navigate the cultural stuff that goes on in addition to being a translator. And that's one of the things that I picked up from that book. I thought, and I highly recommend it.
Very good. Comments?
Well, I agree very strongly. There's great need in the United States to understand the rest of the world, and the United States has acted in various situations in what might be characterized as an arrogant manner. However, I teach undergraduates, and I can tell you very frankly that if you approach economics major in a freshman survey course and you say Americans are arrogant or we have to give up this backward way of looking at the world, that there's not much meat on that bone. That the way in which we have to present it to the average student is in terms of the most pragmatic and rational approach, that this is the world we live in. We may not like it, and there are dangers involved and terrible challenges ahead, but there are also great opportunities. And if we set about systematically figuring out how we will understand the rest of the world, how we will present ourselves to the rest of the world, that is in our long-term strategic interests. And we will find, I believe, that when the United States treats China or India like an equal, not to say that they are equals, that will actually raise America's status in the world at large.
Well, we're going to have to stop here with the promise, I'm sure, that these issues we'll get back to in other ways, other days. But for the moment, we want to say to our guest, Emmanuel Pastreich, he's professor of East Asian Languages and Cultures here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.